Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in Paper 99, Section 2, which is Old Single Column, page 1087. So, we took all of the appropriate time necessary as we started up the block of papers here on the nature of religion last week. And just recall that we're wanting to spend the time that we need to really begin to better differentiate what we've been calling evolutionary religion for a long time, and we're going through those evolution of religion papers, that peculiar outer life phenomenon that's for the last million years has been called religion. Evolutionary religion, as I mentioned at the end of preceding session, you'll see them referring to sort of the final structural consequence of that evolutionary process, and call it institutional religion now. So that outer life fact, so differentiating that outer life fact, whether you call it evolutionary religion or institutional religion, from real religion, which is purely inner life, purely individual in and of itself. It doesn't mean that there aren't fruits of that individual nature. Many religionists get together and their fruits socialize. Okay, there will be, for a long time, there will be an outer life phenomenon that you can still call religion. And as they're talking about all this, a lot of times they just use the word religion and you need to reflect on it. It's like, well, I guess right here they're really kind of talking about institutional religion, and here they're talking about real religion, and here they're kind of talking about both, and it's not constructed in a tedious, pedantic way.
Right on. Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So another part here talks about religious life. It says that people are very religious about things that really have nothing to do with God, so to speak.
Yeah.
So there's a difference here in my mind, which I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah, that's a great point, and that's one of the first things we're going to be engaging tonight is also using the word, say religious, or when, it's obvious they're not sort of talking about anything that has sort of formally ever been called religion, or so. Yeah, so what's the deal there? We need to.
You're religious about your religion.
Yeah, or religious about your diet or whatever, right? All of this complexity, but in the midst of all that complexity, right, I mean, the point isn't just to properly separate and keep all that complexity, laid out in front of you. But the big thing that you're wanting to do is definitively recognize what's been very poorly recognized, in many cases not at all. Real religion, this purely inner life, individual, personal fact, and you'll see we'll get that introduced right away as we start reading tonight. And challenge yourself to try to figure out exactly what that is. Initially, very much apart from anything that's been called religion before, and then come back around and recognize how what has been called religion for the last million years can be made new, right? Behold, all things are becoming new, right? I mean, the only way for that to happen, you see, that's one of the main things we're going to be talking about. The only way for that to happen is for there to be some source for this outer life thing that we call religion that it's never really had before, right? Otherwise, it's just going to, it can't help but be the same old, and, you know, in essence. You can alter the minutiae of rituals and whatnot and, you know, give your sect a different name, you know, but it's still, right, the same basic thing, just repackaged.
When you say some source,
yeah,
what do you mean by that? The source? Or
well, we're going to get to that, but, you know, I'll just remind you, because it'll come up here shortly, that that evolutionary religion that we talked about for so many papers, remember how what its source is. The source is the culture, its mores, and you distill a cult out of that culture. You coalesce a religious nucleus, in the midst of all of the other details of the mores of that culture. So the source, has always been the outer life, the greater outer life. Sure, like we pointed out, there's always been a sort of a super conscious stimulus that's been subtly motivating you to do this whole coalescing thing with the outer life phenomenon. But you know, by and large, the source is out there and not in here where Jesus said you should go to find a new untapped source and subsequently resource.
That's where it is today. I mean, in light life, it might not be there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you get, right.
Yeah, and then again, like we talked about,
there's a truth there.
You get deep into light and life, and the outer life has become so holistic and sophisticated that it's really way transcended something that is fractured into three things you call science, philosophy, and religion. And in that mode, religion is just purely an inner life fact. I mean, it isn't rolling out into some, sort of necessary outer life social structure that kind of seeds society and whatnot. I mean, it's just, you don't need that sort of kind of crutch or whatever, Right. Right, everything is so developed and automatic that you don't have to kind of construct things in this manipulative micromanagement sort of way. Like we talk about with the first four indispensables being cattle prods. There just doesn't have to be any sort of prodding, of civilization. It is just so innately living and dynamic and progressing.
Oh, gray hot.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Okay, so...
I hope that's the case.
All right. So let's... they'll talk a lot about institutional religion. And the first thing they want to do, though, in this section is, speak about its weaknesses. So let's see what they have to say here.
Section 2, weakness of institutional religion. Institutional religion cannot afford inspiration and provide leadership in this impending worldwide social reconstruction and economic reorganization because it has unfortunately become more or less of an organic part of the social order and the economic system which is destined to undergo reconstruction. Only the real religion of personal spiritual experience can function helpfully and creatively in the present crisis of civilization.
Okay, so you can see, literally the first paragraph is teeing up some of these things that we were already talking about. So let's start out with their first comments, which were exactly what we were just talking about. So And they say institutional religion cannot afford inspiration and provide leadership, okay, but it's because it's so balled up in, you know, the outer life institutions, social, political, economic. You know, your first thought should be relative to what I was talking about a minute ago. It's like, well, wait a minute. I mean, I thought, that isn't that nonsensical? I mean, I thought the only way that you can have a, you know, this evolutionary religion, this outer life fact, you know, that becomes institutionalized, is because of how synchronized it is with the rest of the whole moray system. I mean, it, like I just said, it's distilling out of it, isn't it? And so you're going, well, I mean, you know, what are they talking about here? I mean, it's innately sort of by definition tied in like that. Yes, but remember what I also said, you know, we don't want to forget that there's a superconscious motivation, that, you know, an unconscious motivation in every human, no matter how primitive, that is casting a shadow down into their conscious mind that, you know, is stimulating them to do this process of distilling a cult out of the culture, right? So, you know, it isn't, even though it appears to be nothing but something that's coalesced out, you know, invisibly, right? There's a covert inner life fact. But, you know, obviously, you know, since what you really see, you know, an immature person is not aware that he has this inner source that's casting a shadow and all this, like I was just describing. So, you know, he just kind of goes by what he sees, and it's like, well, I get this. You know, they study it, and I see you coalesce this out of the, you know, out of the greater picture. You know, so the more you think about that, the more you start to identify totally outward and kind of start to lose sight of your sort of unrecognized inner stimulation, and it become you start to get completely turned inside out about this. That's what they're talking about, right?
And many of us who've experienced institutionalized religion in our life can totally understand what you're saying.
Right. When it says it has unfortunately become, see, that's because you just there's. All it takes is a little bit of awareness to know that there's something besides what's tangible out there to this phenomenon. But if you don't, if it's sad to record that no one's reflecting really, you lose sight of that quickly. And you think that it's all just out there, and you just get all balled up with all that stuff out there. And that's what they're talking about. And so you could say, well, I mean, is what the planet needs maybe is just, you know, a reclarification. You know, the subtle little mostly superconscious thing, you know, that's served us well for a million years. Can we kind of just get back to that and keep going forward? No. See, the point is because we've, you know, remember they told you we've steamed out of the sheltered bays, okay? That is not going to work anymore.
The anchor's up.
Right. It's anchors away. Right? So, you know, if you don't remember that, you know, that's in the, what is that, the third paragraph of the preceding section? Yeah, the social ship has steamed out of the sheltered bays, right there in that third paragraph. See, so it's now, you know, just an inescapable fact that, we must, you know, like we were joking last week, well, look at all the times they say must, you must do this, you must do that. Right? Yeah, yet another. See, we must have a conscious inner life that is the source ever more than, you know, than over the last million years, ever more so, you know, for this outer life phenomenon. It needs to be lifted up to a level that it can't achieve
without the inner life.
you know, backing into it, right? When everyone is just unconscious and backing into it, right? And at the end of that paragraph, they make it clear that there's a must here, right? To function helpfully and creatively in the present crisis of civilization. As I stress every 5 minutes, every week, right? There's a planetary emergency here, right? There's a civilizational emergency.
Yeah, this was written almost 100 years ago.
Right. It's gotten only worse in all of our oblivious ignorance to this problem, right? So, it's right there in black and white, right? There's a civilizational emergency, and it can only be remedied by having enough individuals with significant conscious inner lives, not just ever more fervent feelings about the outer life. That's not going to get it done. It's your thoughts, not your feelings, that lead you Godward. So that's the basics of that paragraph. But notice what they did in the midst of that paragraph. They gave you the point blank, pithiest definition of what this thing is that's in contrast to evolutionary religion or institutional religion, that outer life phenomenon, that real religion, that inner life phenomenon, real religion of personal spiritual experience. Right? It doesn't explain everything for you, but it's sort of the pithiest way that you can start to reflect on what this phrase "real religion" refers to. Okay, it's experiential. Okay, but it's not, your natural experience with the external world. Right? It's an inner life experience. It's like, well, how do you know that? Well, because of the other two words, which don't have anything directly to do with the lower domain that relates to the external material world, or obviously the external material world. Personal, spiritual. External world that you can experience is material, not spiritual. Despite what, for the last million years, the ghost cult has told you, that there's all this spirit out there doing all kinds of stuff, right? No, okay? There's no spirit land out there that you can experience right now, right? Sure, one day you will experience that, but not now.
Right? You have a guardian angel, maybe.
Yeah. You tell me when you stub your toe on a spirit brick, and then we'll talk about spirit out there, right?
Time for some physics.
Right. When you can show me, your bloody toe because you've tripped over a spirit brick, okay, then we'll talk about an external world that's spiritual.
Of course, it'd have to be my spiritual.
See when
they'll see it.
Okay.
Maybe it doesn't bleed.
But right now, this is a purely inner life fact because it says spiritual. All you need is that. But even more so, right, is adding personal. So not only is it inner life, it's personal. In other words, it is absolutely individuated. This real religion that you can have has absolutely no overlap with anyone else's real religion because it's personal.
And how can you tell when you're having it?
And how can you tell? Right. But see, like I said, there's so many questions, but you start with just these three words as a challenge to at least start with being able to know what it isn't. It's like, well, is it this? It's like, oh, no, that's material. Well, is it this? No, that's a group thing. Is it this? No. See, you those three little words help you to begin to set aside what it isn't. And, you know, if you can push aside more and more of what is it obviously isn't, then your natural growth process, assuming you're supplying favorable conditions, will continue to mature your recognition to the point where in the space that you've cleared of all the clutter and clamoring, you'll find a still small voice that you never noticed there before. Right? And you'll have this experience that they're talking about. Right? You'll know it's real. So you're not just imagining this because you desperately want to have this real religion, right? You know, so you know, you got to be careful, right? If you're desperate like that, you can imagine lots of things, right? And fool yourself that you've found this.
Plenty of people like that.
Okay. Right. So, so you're looking for this discovery of a new experiential object that doesn't have anything whatsoever to do with matter or the external world. So you just hold on to that, right? I mean, and you know, don't try to flesh it all out immediately. Just start with that little anchor. There's obviously a lot of maturing, and you got to better figure out what the word personal refers to. You got to better figure out what the word spiritual refers to. You may not know this, but you've got to figure out what the word experience actually means. The best minds that have ever lived have been trying and have not been able to come up with a definition of human experience. That may startle you, but that's why it's given in the Arantia book. For the first time, right, we have the definition of what human experience is. Because people have been groping around trying to figure that one out for a long time, you know. You think, oh, everyone knows what experience is. Yeah. The more you reflect on it, the more it slips through your fingers, and you're going, you know, I don't think I have any idea what it is. You know, I'll guarantee you, the best minds have been confused about this for a long time, many centuries.
It's not a simple answer.
It's a complicated thing. It's got a lot of details to it. There's a physics to experience that we've never had the sophistication to be able to sort out. So all three words have lots of question marks to them. Okay, but they give you a starting point, like I said, at least to challenge you a little bit about what we aren't talking about.
Let's go back to this for 2 seconds. Yep. Something you mentioned in the beginning, mm-hmm. where he said, well, okay, institutionalized religion, so why don't you just morph that? You know, and you said, no, you can't even do that. But really, what the second part you're talking about is really personal religion. Yeah. It's which is what everybody's real religion with God is. So it seems to me there is a place for being able to have the parish, so to speak, have personal religion, and then also be able to get together in some sort of an institutional thing sort of gets us from here to there to where.
And of course, that's exactly what we're going to be talking about in this section. That's what they, but before you can remake that outer life phenomenon that, as they're just saying, needs to be there, to prevent this collapse of civilization. And we aren't so advanced that we can do this without that external thing we're going to call religion. Okay? But we need a way to make it, to get it above the morass that needs to be improved, okay? And you know, there's no bootstrapping mechanism out of there that's going to magically lift itself up, right? Yeah. So we have to create this vertical distance from that morass inside ourselves, and then we pour out into the world that uplifting influence on civilization, right? Remember, all of this is because we didn't get the civilizational uplifters of the first epical revelation. Right? This, the fact that this says present crisis of civilization, that goes all the way back to 200,000 years ago. That's where this all started, what led to this emergency.
So surprise.
We need civilizational uplifters, okay? We're not going to get one waltzing in, you know, out there like they did 500,000 years ago, anytime soon. Right? So it's got to happen inside. We have to be the civilizational uplifters, right?
Each individual person
has to be a measure of civilizational uplift, right? And together we can make up for the fact that we don't have a prince and his staff. Yeah. It's not happening tomorrow. Right. But like you're saying, this is the only solution.
Interesting.
Right? Okay.
Well, that's the other part of what's being talked about here. I know this is about religion, but they're talking about worldwide social reconstruction. They're talking as though we need to do 180 degrees thing here.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. But, you know, that doesn't happen with the finger snap.
No, right. I mean, what we're talking about is something that eventually could be beyond our imagination for an outer life. You know, a normal post-pastoral sun age. Right. So, you know, use whatever analogy you want, 180 degrees or whatever, you know, I mean, we're talking a major change to, you know, what we think of and can even imagine as an outer life, you know, the best science fiction novelist or whatever. You know, we're talking something way beyond anything ever imagined for an idyllic outer life. Yeah, you know, it's not that it hasn't been imagined. It's not imaginable.
But it can exist in any, you know, economic or industrial age, in my opinion, if the people have that love for one another, that spiritual brotherhood, the outer life is not, you know, is, or the happiness or whatever that comes from whatever your outer life is, still, you know, then comes from within, from everybody. So you don't necessarily have to be super technically advanced, correct?
Well, yeah, I mean, of course not. But again, you know, we've got two different issues. You know, we've got the issue of whether or not you can find contentment no matter what the outer life is. And even pursue happiness, you know, in the face of rank adversity, right, or whatever. Okay, but so there's that. But, you know, there isn't that sort of individual emergency anymore. That was fundamentally fixed 2,000 years ago. I mean, so the emergency is real. It's really, you got to care about this stuff. You know, even if you've got it together, even if all earthly things crash and you're fine, okay, or all earthly things just crashed. And you know, it'll become very difficult for anyone to have the requisite environment to have time to reflect and have an inner life. Right? If it gets really, really nasty out there, right? I mean, remember, you know, when you're in the nutrition epic, the only time anyone's thinking is when they're hungry. So pursuing the fineries of real religion is not even, you know, in the picture, right? You'll be trying to figure out how to, you know, live for another 24 hours, you know, because the hordes are, you know, wanting to tear you asunder. So, yeah, it's there's a limit to how much anyone can have any sort of an inner life. I mean, that's what, you know, the right, you know, to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I mean, that's what that's all about, you know, is setting things up so that people actually have the opportunity to pursue an inner life, right? And there's a minimum threshold that you couldn't get there during the Dark Ages. That's why it's called the Dark Ages, because there was no inside.
If you're stressed out and have a lot of anxiety, it's going to be hard to work.
If you're full of fear and hunger,
that's true.
Right. It's just you can't get there.
Yes.
Yep.
So, personal spiritual experience. Mm-hmm. So I've learned that a arithmetic and geometric phenomenon. So when you have a personal spiritual experience, so is that kind of a geometric phenomenon thing in there where it's going to multiply?
It's, yeah, I mean, that experiential object can be analogized as a mustard seed, like Jesus did. Right? It on first blush, it appears to be a little thing, but don't underestimate it because it has geometric consequences. Right? A little will go a long way. Right? So this crisis of civilization, don't falsely judge the situation. Right? I mean, you look at the quantity of the problem, you think, well, it's hopeless. Right? It's because you're thinking arithmetically. A few mustard seeds on the planet, real mustard seeds, would make a massive difference. Right? A little real spirit has a gigantic material consequence. Right? The mustard tree is huge. Right? So that's, yes, very much. This is what you're trying to fix an arithmetically insolvable problem by transcending the arithmetic. Right? It's the only way to solve it. It's too big to solve arithmetically. You can do fancier molecular rearrangement out there, and you're going to lose. It can't be achieved that way. Success can't be achieved that way.
Yeah, I was thinking one person with real wisdom, insight, and foresight can have huge ramifications.
Yeah.
If you're just going legacy, tradition, and convention, you're just... Right. You can't even differentiate yourself from the fray. You're in the middle of it.
Yeah, right. It's just an unsolvable problem with legacy, tradition and convention. You can't solve it that way.
Plus, you were saying, I remember you saying that a leader could come up.
Right, and that's what he was referring to when he's bringing up the wisdom, insight, foresight. That's about leaders, right? And you don't even need 1% mustard seeds. Hey, and you've got all you need. That's how geometric it is. So,
I know somebody who started with 12.
From Beth, we have, how has religion become an organic part of our economic system? I get the social part, but I'm unclear about the economic reorganization.
Oh, let's hold that off. I mean, you're going to be talking about that more as we go forward. And we'll flesh that out, and we can think about how religion gets all balled up in the social, political, and the economic. Just hold that, and we'll talk about it a lot more as we go forward here.
Institutional religion is now caught in the stalemate of a vicious circle. It cannot reconstruct society without first reconstructing itself. And being so much an integral part of the established order, it cannot reconstruct itself until society has been radically reconstructed.
Catch 22. Just to emphasize again, that is, that's the bootstrap analogy, right? You can't fix this from within. Right? You need to have something outside, and specifically above. You need a source above. Right? Otherwise, you're chasing your tail down in the plane. It's just not going to get anywhere. There's no, and there's not even any potential for uplift. Okay? The only way there's ever uplift is if there's something that's already up there. Right. The only way for you to ever become an absentite being eventually, a seventh, you know, stage spirit, is if there's someone already up there who can reach across the boundary down and grab a hold of you and lift you up. The Supreme Being gives you a measure, a spirit measure of himself that lifts you up from a 6 to a 7. It lifts you across the boundary of supremacy and up into obscenity. And I mean, you know, that's a grand example of it, but I mean, it's just true in general. You know, there's no way that the lower domain, the hourglass analogy of yourself, is ever going to be improved if there isn't an upper domain. It can't improve itself. It can't uplift itself. Right? That's the whole bootstrap analogy again, right? You have to have something that's already above. It's like, well, how can I have something that's above? I can't bootstrap myself. You have to be given by grace something above, right? You can't build it yourself. It has to just be given to you. And then, but once it's there, it's above, and you can use it to lift the stuff that's below up.
Does spiritual gravity help too?
Yeah, sure, right? I mean, yeah, that's the kind of the way you can think literally about the why there's an uplift, right? You know, why are we analogizing, you know, reaching down to the hand and pulling up? I mean, what's literally pulling up is not a hand, it's spiritual gravity, right? That's literally lifting up, but... But still, see, that's, so, you know, that's the essence of what they're talking about here. I mean, that's, you know, if you understand that, you get the whole gist of what they're going to be talking about. We need to have individuals with upper domains so they can lift up their lower domains, which are in interplay with the external world, and hence the external world gets lifted up. That's the only way to do it. Right? Short of, you know, someone coming out there and grabbing hold of it and lifting it up, you know, and yeah, the next one that's supposed to arrive is the Magisterial Son, and basically his job is to get you to have an insight that lifts your lower domain up, and yeah, he's not going to, you know, come with some forklift and lift us all up out there. You know, it's not going to be like the, you know, prince and his staff. So... All right, let's keep going.
Religionists must function in society, in industry, and in politics as individuals, not as groups, parties, or institutions. A religious group which presumes to function as such, apart from religious activities, immediately becomes a political party, an economic organization, or a social institution. Religious collectivism must confine its efforts to the furtherance of religious causes.
Okay, so see, I've already basically pointed this out. Religionists must function in society as individuals. Okay, so obviously, what are we talking about? We're talking about real religionists here, which is a purely individual fact. I mean, that's all they can do. So what it's really saying is, be a real religionist, see, and then automatically you function as an individual, and not as a, you know, just a, an element in a collective. You need to be that a mustard seed, and there will be automatic fruits of the spirit that are going to impact society, industry, politics, like they're saying. So, you know, here you can see the question that she asked just a second ago. I mean, we're already getting into it. See more in this next paragraph. Right, if you've got a so-called religious group and they aren't purely focused on the inner life, but on some outer life thing, like we said up front, even if initially maybe they're also focusing on the inner life, the material gravity is going to suck them all into the outer life in short order, and you'll have this unfortunately thing, you know, in the first paragraph again, right? It's all turned inside out, you know, and they may call themselves a religion, but they're not. What are they? They're a political party, an economic organization, or a social institution.
And sometimes all three.
And sometimes all three. Yeah. You know, and the specific, you know, when you're thinking about economic, you know, remember the expression that is most used these days when, you know, the immediate thing that you're concerned about is economic, social justice. If you're concerned about the poor, that's an economic thing. It's not a religious thing. If you're concerned about, you know, for or against some political party, okay, that's obviously a political thing. Now, you know, they're going to go on and stress, you know, as they were just hinting at the beginning, I mean, individual real religionists will engage political, social, economic things, okay? But we have to have, we're not far enough along, like we were saying before, where we can get by without an outer life thing called institutional religion. There needs to be institutional religion still. But it's going to be consciously predicated on real individual religionists. No. And you know, that, so we're talking about that institutional religion, this new and improved institutional religion, as a collective phenomenon, has to stay bounded away from social, political, and economic issues.
There's no such thing today.
There is no such thing today. That's why we have a present crisis of civilization. All right, there just is no such thing. Right? They're like John was saying, if they're not involved in one, you know, they may be involved in all three.
And it's not just a Christian religion you're talking
about. No, and it's not just a Christian religion.
Or want to be.
I mean, you know, the Tibetan Buddhists want us to free Tibet. Okay, that's not a religious group. What is that? Huh, that's a political party. They're talking about political issues. They're not talking about religious issues. All right, so, you know, I mean, you know, and probably the most insidious one, the sneakiest one, I mean, the political and the economic are a little bit easier to notice that you're getting into because they are... they're, you know, much closer to the individuality end of the spectrum. Or you have, you know, an important thing to think about. You've got a spectrum. We have science on one end and religion on the other end, individuality on one end, unity on the other end. And if you move towards unity from science, you get politics. If you move towards science, from religion, you get, you know, society, you know, or sociology. So you have science, politics, society, and religion as a spectrum from individuality to unity. Okay. So, and economics is literally a science, right? See, science, you know, economics and politics are on that individuality end. Society and religion are, you know, on the unity end. Right? So the sneakiest one is the one that's closest to religion, just society, you know, social things itself, like, you know, that social institution thing. I mean, a religious institution will become a social institution without even thinking about it, because it's just so close. You ooze over across the line without even noticing you're doing it. Yeah.
It's fuzzy in my mind exactly what is a social institution.
Yeah, well, I don't want to, because there's a whole bunch of things that give us for thinking about that. So, yeah, we'll get to that to be able to talk about it a little bit more. But you know, but the whole economic thing is like, well, I'm in a church and we don't talk about economics. I bet you talk about the poor. That's an economic issue. It's not a spiritual issue.
Unless it's the porn spirit.
Yeah.
When I used to think about these things, you know, when you think about, oh, we need to have, you know, social gatherings, we need to have, you know, social this, that, and the other thing in order to, you know, get together with other like-minded religious folk and, you know, talk about religious things, and, you know, those things necessarily go together. So how do you separate that in your mind?
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, I want, everyone has said some, their gears turning, got questions going. You know, let's just go forward paragraph by paragraph and see. I mean, you'll see that they're
reflective thinking.
They, you know, they keep leading us from paragraph to paragraph, and hopefully you've got questions as you go to the next paragraph so you can see where they take us here. They're giving us some suggestions and some hints to start working on this. How do you keep this separate? What does separate mean even? Okay.
Religionists are of no more value in the tasks of social reconstruction than non-religionists, except insofar as their religion has conferred upon them enhanced cosmic foresight and endowed them with that superior social wisdom which is born of the sincere desire to love God supremely and to love every man as a brother in the heavenly kingdom. An ideal social order is that in which every man loves his neighbor as he loves himself.
Okay, so start with the beginning there. Religionists are of no more value in the task of social reconstruction than non-religionists, except dot, dot, dot. Okay, why? Because of the first paragraph, right? If what you mean by a religionist is just a member of one of these phenomena that are purely synchronized with the outer life phenomenon, right, then there's no difference, right? You know, there is no religionist in contrast to non-religionist. Everyone's a non-religionist then, really, if it's all just an outer life thing that's totally sloshed around and gotten into resonance with, you know, the whole social construct.
I'm fairly intimate with this question because the religionists that I know imagine or assume, because they are saved, children of God, true believers, that they have this requisite wisdom, that they're already there.
Right.
So they feel compelled to go out and change the world because they see themselves as the gifted ones.
Right, right. The chosen ones, you know, who've been touched by God and hence have what the world needs. Right? You know, and of course, when we studied evolutionary religion, it's like, well, what do they really have? They've got ideas from the ghost cult. This difference between religionist and non-religionist, well, okay, maybe the so-called religionist doesn't just have the facts of the social construct out there. He probably has his figments of spirit land out there. So, oh boy, that's really going to help, you know, improve the facts out there, bringing in superstitious figments. Yeah, that's going to help a lot.
When you try to turn their direction inward, their immediate response to that is, That's selfish,
yes.
That's selfish. Well, you don't go to church to become more selfish. You go to church to learn how to turn yourself out.
Yeah. See, and it's just, like I said, it's so wrong, right? I mean, real religion is personal spiritual experience. It's absolutely separate from everything and every being. It's the exact opposite of what? No, I mean
yourself. Right?
Yeah, except, yeah. I mean, you're an island universe, right? You know, and if you fully spin up the absolute dimension of your personality, right? There isn't even the Universal Father there. It's just you. It's like, you know, another thing that, you know, related to this, I bring up all the time. You have kind of the normal thoughts about spiritual things and whatnot. You find the Arantia book and you discover there's an ascension career. And see, what is the first thing they tell you? Instead of saying, well, you die and you melt into the wonderful bliss of spirit. No, they tell you that step one is to become definitively individuated. See, again, like, it's just the opposite of what those so-called religionists think God expects you to do first. Right? Because again, the only way for you to really add something is for you to be really different from what's already there. There's no real relationship, no super additive consequence.
Kind of way of saying for you to be you?
I mean, you have to be different than the ocean if you're going to add anything to the ocean.
It doesn't mean you don't have love and other things like that that can
right.
bring there. Yeah.
But again, see, but you can't really, you know, help someone if you are them. Right? I mean, you know they need help. It's like, you know, so... You know, it's like, well, they don't really need anyone besides themselves, you know, so I can just be exactly like them and help them. It's like, no, you know, they need something besides what they have. There has to be a separation.
Yeah. No differential.
There's no differential. Right? So nothing is really going to happen. You know, the only reason anything exists is to create true relationship. And you can't have, you got to start with real separation before you can have real relationship, let alone true relationship. Putting it in the, you know, the spherical context. So, right, there's a basic logical point that everyone's missing, right? You know, and it's unfortunately become more or less an organic part. If you're just like that, you're not really going to help anyone. You're just a more zealous same old. You're just going to make it worse. Right? At least it might be lacking what's out there, but at least it isn't insanely zealous. So it's not going to blow up tomorrow. But if you go out there same old, only adding zeal, you're just going to cause the world to blow up tomorrow instead of 5 years from now. It's just not going to be what you were hoping.
Can we get tired of something that everyone's already seen? Can we be tired of it?
We all know people talk about how it's, you know, you're crazy if you're going to do the same thing over and over again and expect a different result. Right? Yeah. And yet we all do it. Yeah. It's like, well, I'm different, right? Because I've got, you know, commitment or zeal or whatever. Yeah?
Passionate.
I'm passionate or, yeah. It's like, no. Okay. All right, but you definitely saw what Gene was kind of hinting at, you know, the wisdom, insight, and foresight. They're alluding to there in that paragraph. That's what needs to be added. And then when you think about what they described there, which is born of the sincere desire to love God supremely and to love every man as a brother. Okay, here's where we need to, again, start thinking critically. That sentence, or that just that little passage of that sentence that I just read, uses the word love twice. Love God, love every man. Those aren't the same word love. So two different loves, separated by two levels of meaning. Right? Desire to love God, that love is on the sixth level of meaning. Right? Kind of love that is completely separated from all others, like we were just talking about. Right? Personal realization of divine fellowship with God. Right? You can take that sixth level of meaning definition of love and replace the word love by it. Desire to have, Right. A personal realization, right, of divine fellowship with God. Paper 16, Section 6, right? We're talking about the third cosmic intuition, gives you that. Okay, but, you know, just think about it. Personal realization of divine fellowship with every man. Okay, well, oh yeah, if I'm divine and he's divine, well, let's imagine that I'm divine and he's divine, and then we're going to have a personal realization of divine fellowship. It's like, no, you're not. Right? That's delusional. All right, you've obviously downstepped here. You've downstepped to the fourth level, the level of kindness, kin-likeness, brotherly love. Right? Right, so that love is kindness. Right, to show kindness to every man, you know, as a brother. To be kind to every man as a brother. And continuing on, you know, that expression, every man loves his neighbor as he loves himself. If you put sixth level of meaning in there, you're playing with Lucifer. Loving yourself, self-love? Okay, no. Right, that's kindness. Right? You know, that's kin-likeness, that's brotherly, you know, so-called brotherly love. you know, a lot of people have stumbled over that. They go, well, it says you love your neighbors, you love yourself. I mean, so I think self-love, that's, see, I mean, you just gotten unwittingly sucked into the Lucifer manifesto there when you think that way. Right? I mean, that's, you know, the self-esteem movement is problematic enough, right, to go up to the fifth level of meaning from the proper self-respect on the fourth. But to go up two levels to self-admiration, self-love, okay, now you've really gone astray. Right. Yeah, so see, there's not only is religion, you know, you got to think about the word religion, you got to think about the word love. See, they didn't put any adjectives or anything. I mean, they just used the word twice. It looks like they're talking about the same thing. It's like, no, they're talking about something very different.
And in the beginning of the book, they tell you, wish they had another word.
Right. Right. Yeah, yeah, not to mention, this is another reason why to use love for the sixth level of meaning thing is problematic. I mean, just this makes it problematic that you've got a thing on the fourth level that's actually relatively fancy. But, you know, what if you the word love means a feeling to you on the second level or a sex act on the first level?
Nathaniel.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Is there anything else there?
The term cosmic foresight.
Yeah, I was just gonna. I thought you might want. I was just gonna give some more explanation there. So you have, you know, the full triplet is wisdom, insight, foresight. You can see they talk about, you know, wisdom there, superior social wisdom. You know, they mention foresight, but they don't directly say insight. But you're reminded of that by just saying cosmic foresight. Your foundational fact is insight, the cosmic intuitions. They're innately cosmic. Okay, if you apply that insight forward towards the future, you have foresight. If you apply that insight to reflecting upon past experiences, you can gain wisdom from those experiences. You can't have foresight or wisdom without insight first. Insight is the foundational fact. That threefold cosmic insight, right, which you apply forward, you got cosmic foresight.
Is that why you have to have experience?
Yeah, and you've got to have some experience to reflect upon with, you know, to apply your insights to get wisdom, right? I mean, you can't just be handed wisdom, right? Like you're handed insight. See, you're just handed insight. But you transform that into a foresight. You transform that into a wisdom.
Yeah. Wisdom.
So as a society, if we corrupt our history, we divorce ourselves from wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have no
Of course, yeah.
No
way to get right. A whole lesson of reliving history. You cut off, you short-circuited what that history has to offer.
Yeah.
You got to, then what?
Right. I mean,
you experience of it.
You know, because there's a civilizational emergency, a philosophic emergency. I mean, everything about what's going on, right, you know, is an element of that emergency. Right? How we're forgetting, you know, the lessons of the past, you know, for ideological reasons and, you know, whatnot. And, I mean, it's so problematic, you know. You know, for purity desires, you tear down statues or whatever. I mean, all those things are part and parcel of this civilizational emergency. You know. All right, let's keep going here.
The institutionalized church may have appeared to serve society in the past by glorifying the established political and economic orders, but it must speedily cease such action if it is to survive. Its only proper attitude consists in the teaching of nonviolence, the doctrine of peaceful evolution in the place of violent revolution, peace on earth, and goodwill among men.
Okay, so there's giving you a kind of a simple little concrete nugget, you know, to think about this proper religion, you know, as an outer life institution, you know, what voice it can helpfully provide, right, to the rest of the world. That same thing that, you know, Jesus as a spiritual uplifter, you know, avoided getting into details of politics, economics, sociology, but he certainly would remind people, revolution, no, never. Right? See, he's not mucking in, you know, in social, you know, political and economic issues when he's doing that. He's providing what religion should provide. Right? That basic recognition that we can get there through evolution. We don't need revolution. But then, of course, you go, oh, wait a minute, a lot of religionists don't believe in evolution. Yeah, okay, see, that's a problem. Because in the act of not believing in evolution, they're going to unwittingly become revolutionaries. Right, it's inescapable.
Something's got to scratch that itch.
Right.
And evolution doesn't do it.
And even those who believe in biologic evolution reject social evolution, which is the kind of evolution we're talking about here. Yeah. Right. So everyone, it's an across-the-board problem. They're all going to become revolutionaries.
Instead of revelationaries.
Instead of revelationaries. That real religionist that is a revelationary, right, see? Right? He has the revelation within that pours out into the world.
Fine coinage there, Tom.
Yes.
The trademark. That's great. Go for it.
Now, you know, and of course, when you talk about nonviolence, you know, here, we, you know, you've got to distinguish between, it doesn't mean a nation can't ever go to war, right? I mean, if a religionist starts to think that his voice of nonviolence means that he's got to stop his country from going to war, see, now he's confused again. Now he's getting into political stuff again. So, you can see they basically explain that right there, you know.
So the individual needs to make a separation between his inner life and his outer life.
Yes, he does, right? Or, this quickly becomes all muddled up.
Did you mention must yet?
Yes, must. Right. It's just endless musts, yes. I know.
Modern religion finds it difficult to adjust its attitude toward the rapidly shifting social changes only because it has permitted itself to become so thoroughly traditionalized, dogmatized, and institutionalized. The religion of living experience finds no difficulty in keeping ahead of all these social developments and economic upheavals, amid which it ever functions as a moral stabilizer, social guide, and spiritual pilot. True religion carries over from one age to another the worthwhile culture and that wisdom which is born of the experience of knowing God and striving to be like Him.
Okay, so the basic physics of that paragraph is that it's just a simple recognition that that which is fully ensconced in the external world phenomena, by definition, can't help but be caught up in all of its ebbs and flows and vicissitudes and whatnot. It's impossible for anything out there to somehow stand unmoved. Only thing that can really stand unmoved is that which is not out there. You can't somehow isolate yourself enough. You know, you're out there. If you're out there, you're out there. Right? Only that which is genuinely inside, in the inner life, not your feelings about the outer life, but the real inner life, right, stands apart. Obviously, your feelings about the outer life don't stand apart from the outer life. They're all caught up in the outer life. Right? The level of feelings is in the lower domain. Your lower domain is in interplay with the outer life. You can't. There's no way to turn that off. Right? Only the inner life, the upper domain, innately stands apart. Now, like we've talked about, you can unfortunately will it to be just like what's out there by dragging all the stuff out there and remaking the upper domain. Okay. But by grace, if you go back to what you were given as a child, like Jesus said, what's up there is not what's out there. It's different. And it's what out there needs as a source point. Right? What they're describing here. See, if that inner domain, right, doesn't have any problem keeping up with all these social developments and economic upheavals. I mean, it's above it. It's reflecting down upon all that stuff. It stands unmoved. All earthly things can crash, and it just sits there. Right? Because it's not predicated on time, that upper domain. It's predicated on eternity. You know? Foundationally, it has absolutely nothing to do with time.
Much of it is a gift from God.
And it's purely a gift from God, obviously. I can't somehow bootstrap time into eternity. I have to be given a relationship to eternity by grace, from that which is in there, in eternity already. That's the fundamental differential that's going on here. When they talk about traditionalized, dogmatized, institutionalized, notice the dogmatized one there, like I said. Right? If you drag the external world up there, those three seats up there, 4, 5, and 6, scientific dictation, social usage, and religious dogma, then you don't have an inner life, really. See, you've made your inner life in the outer life's image. Yeah. It's not in God's image anymore.
Right. Would be an outist,
right? It's in man's image. Yeah. Right? You're a humanist.
And we all start out there. You have to evolve out of that. It's almost like when they talked about Jesus. Whatever year it was, I said that he's almost completed the mastery of his mind. So it's,
yep,
you almost have to get to a point where you work at it, so to speak.
Right. I mean, think of all the definitive things that Jesus was taught that he had to overcome to think objectively. Right? But notice he didn't overcome them through revolution. You know, like I pointed out, I mean, they make a point of emphasizing how his early religious upbringing was lockstep precisely what every other Jew's was. That's adequate. The only difference is, for him, it was a beginning. For all of his fellows, it was an ending. That's the only thing. You don't have to change anything through revolution. Just use it as a beginning instead of an ending. That's all you have to do. Nothing has to change. But if you use it as a beginning, you'll change. And then guess what? The fruits of the Spirit are automatic. And what's out there will change. But not because you built it, you know, differently.
And every day as if it were on purpose.
This is what they're talking about. This is what the world needs. See anything else there? Because it has permitted itself. See, again, it's in our hands. I mean, material gravity doesn't turn off. You have to choose to be something besides what material gravity produces. Material gravity will turn you inside out. And if you permit it, and God's not going to say, "Oh, I've got to stop that material gravity because it's turning Chris inside out." That's not the way it works. I have free will.
There could not be an inside and outside of that.
So it's in our hands. You have to catch yourself and kind of go back before. I mean, we'll get to this in this next section. This whole issue of how little you have to turn yourself inside out to go from religion to society, it's right there. It's right next door. It takes so little, you won't even notice that you've done it, that you've inverted yourself at least to that degree. Maybe you haven't flipped yourself all the way, you know, out to politics or even beyond to economics, okay? But
it starts as an entry drive.
But it starts, right? Right, yeah. It's a gateway drug. Society is a gateway drug. Yes.
Of course, you have to serve two masters. You know.
That's what I was going
to
say.
And that's the. And yet, you have to serve two masters. See.
Balance that.
Right. Well, so again,
that's the fun of it all. Learning how to balance it and get better at it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the whole point, isn't it?
It is.
I mean, if it was just snap your fingers. Yes. And
should I have an inner life or an outer life? Yes.
There wouldn't be any difference. Not if they got it. That's the whole point of experiencing, I think.
Well,
was there something...
But how do you keep turning inside out when you're trying to balance that? I mean,
it's a skill, right? You know, Jesus, I think, said... I think Jesus said something that involved Caesar in a coin.
Yeah.
Right? Right. Right. You can do it. Right? But you have to stay conscious. You have to be self-aware. If you're not self-aware, material gravity will just do its thing. Right. Again, it's paper 16, section 6. The only thing you have to do to prevent any of these unfortunate things from happening is reflect. That's all you have to do. Have a reflective life. Right. By grace, that reflective life is separate from the outer life stuff.
and it's relatively motionless in relation
to it is relatively motionless in relationship to all the chaos out there. Just one other little thing before we go on there. Notice when they say true religion, like they did there, true religion carries over. See, so you take this real religion predicated, you know, purely on individuals. And you can put it into that greater holistic context, you know, the true context. See, and then it functions, you know, from one age to another, right? All those things carrying over the worthwhile culture. I mean, worthwhile. Space, time. Right? I mean, you can take that which is of eternity and bring it into relationship with space and time through truth. You know, like field number two on the chart here. Fact, truth, goodness, that kind of truth. That kind of truth that's tied to fact, the facts of time and space. So, you know, when you talk about true religion, you know, then it's engaging the temporal and the spatial. The real religion is in and of itself. It's just you holding on to your God-given foundation in eternity and experiencing that. All right.
Section 3, Religion and the Religionist. Early Christianity was entirely free from all civil entanglements, social commitments, and economic alliances. Only did later institutionalized Christianity become an organic part of the political and social structure of Occidental civilization.
The Holy Roman Empire, you know, what have you. Okay, but let's just focus on one thing. There's a million things you can talk about there, obviously, but just focus on one glaring challenge that's in the midst of all that. Early Christianity was entirely free from all social commitments. Most so-called religionists, that's all they are, is an endless sequence of social commitments. I mean, you know, just, you know, you let that one sink in. I mean, and that's just, you know, I mean, there's an awful lot of people that's what they think being a religionist is always having a next scheduled social commitment to go over and see Betty, you know, or to clean the church or, you know, or whatever. Hey, but Jesus wasn't totally unsuccessful. He did get them started out where they knew that they were trying to do an inner life thing. They were not trying. You know, and of course, it kind of helped that if they poked their head outside, it was chopped off, you know, and they were fed to the lions. That helped them to not get all wrapped up in politics and stuff, right?
yeah, that would help.
they were weak in the outer world.
Yeah. But now let's not overplay this. You know, say, we need to go back to early Christianity where it's purely, it's like, no. I mean, there needs, like I've been saying, there needs to be an institutionalized religion. Because we're a long ways from light and life. Yeah, but it just needs to be new and improved. But they're just reminding you that 2,000 years ago, they started out, you know, with mostly just an inner life thing, and material gravity for the last 2,000 years has been dragging it down and out, right? By the time you get to the 4th century, right, it becomes, you know, the religion of the Roman Empire, and, right, you know, it's slowly being dragged, and you go, well, that was really important. I mean, you know, yeah, it is important for this stuff to get out there, but they're telling us it's now a time where we've got to bring in some spiritual gravity. We can't, you're not going to sail the high seas turned inside out like this. Like the last 2,000 years of material gravity has achieved. You've got to reconstitute your inner life as a conscious element, like it was, you know, a conscious element. You know, if it's entirely free, okay, this is a conscious thing. They're consciously not getting involved. It's not just that they don't want to get, you know, fed to the lions. They're saying, it's like, no. You know, this is a spiritual brotherhood, not a social brotherhood, political brotherhood, an economic brotherhood. It's a spiritual brotherhood. And, you know, let's see what they say about that in the next paragraph.
The kingdom of heaven is neither a social nor economic order. It is an exclusively spiritual brotherhood of God-knowing individuals. True, such a brotherhood is in itself a new an amazing social phenomenon attended by astounding political and economic repercussions.
Okay, so I was already teasing that. It's a spiritual brotherhood. But notice God knowing again. That was in that last paragraph of the preceding section, too. Let's pause and just notice that, because they've re-emphasized it. You know, up there, and it said, which is born of the experience of knowing God and striving to be like him. Okay, and here they're saying God knowing individuals. That's, remember, God knowingness is on the sixth level of meaning. Okay, real God knowingness. Born of the experience of knowing God and striving to be like him. They're not talking about, oh yeah, I'm very pious, I'm very into the ghost cult God. That's not what they're talking about. Right? First miler's not going to get us what we're looking for here. Right? Lots and lots of lip service to, right, you know, God, you know, as a material technique and all that sort of stuff. It is not what they're talking about. Talking about genuine God-knowingness, right? At which we know almost nothing of, because happiness is also there, and they tell you that we know almost nothing of happiness, right? And you can't look up faith in the dictionary. All those six level of meaning things, right? The personal realization of divine fellowship, right? I mean, is that one of the senses of the word love in the dictionary? Not hardly, right? So remind yourself, they're talking about sixth level of meaning, genuine God knowing. This is being the predicate here for all these wonderful consequences, okay? Two levels above brotherly love. Two levels above kindness. So there's that. And then, you know, look at that last sentence. You know, true, such a brotherhood is in itself a new and amazing social phenomenon. Why is this thing so amazing? And, you know, and why are there astounding political and economic repercussions? I mean, you know, why would this be shocking? Because how many people get together in a group, based upon a common recognition, you know, that what they have in common is a spiritual inner nature? You know, regardless of all the outer life things, you know, and let's take probably the most glaring example. Remember, there's two things you can't talk about in polite company, right? Religion and politics. So obviously, if I bring in politics, this will make the point, right? I mean, as animal origin creatures, naturally, we don't even want to be in the same room with someone who has a different political viewpoint than us. Imagine how amazing and astounding it would be if people with very different political viewpoints nonetheless got together in a group and were just, you know, blind.
Came to Capitol Hill every day?
Blind, yeah, not to be, yeah, imagine if they came to work at Capitol Hill, right, yeah. We haven't gotten to that paragraph yet, but we'll eventually get to that paragraph, right? I mean, but just, you know, amongst out there, you know, you know, in the hinterlands, right? Far removed from D.C. That's the easiest way to, you know, get what they're talking about here is amazing and astounding. Right? What if you got together based on the content of your character instead of the color of your political skin, let alone your skin, right? I mean, just think about how challenging this is. I mean, it doesn't matter if you've been reading Urantia book for 50 years. There's nothing natural about spending any length of time in the same room with someone that has a very different political view than you. it's just, you know, basically horrid. It's so disturbing, right? If someone has a very different political view than you do, that just brings it all to a point. That's what the kind of thing they're talking about here. Imagine if you actually had people. A lot of people give lip service to spiritual brotherhoods, but really, no. I mean, you watch them get together in a group, and they all talk about politics. And they can because they all have exactly the same political viewpoint. They're not a spiritual brotherhood, they're a political brotherhood. You know, and if someone that has a different political viewpoint comes in as a skunk at the party, right, they'll go, oh, we're still a spiritual brotherhood. I mean, no, you know, they say, you just shattered the spiritual brotherhood. It's like, no, they didn't. You didn't have a spiritual brotherhood to begin with.
Stunk up.
And the same tension you're describing is going to be present, you know, in a way we've never experienced when you represent yourself as an individual. Right then and there, you're confronted with a tension like no other, and then see if there's kindness.
Mm-hmm.
Right away.
Yeah. You know,
that's your litmus test is. We're not even there.
Yeah. Express a diametrically opposite political viewpoint and see if you're the recipient of kindness. Yeah, right.
Which
you kindly leave.
Yes. So if we had a group of folks that had a true cosmic perspective and understanding and were with that understanding, were living the truth in their outer life, you know, as the fruits spilled into their outer life, and they were all in the same room, you know, they would have a lot of different ideas because they have a lot of different, they were each created with different patterns. And so those, you know, it would manifest, the fruits would manifest differently. But I think that there would be more harmony because it would be based on a true perspective,
mm-hmm.
even if it comes out different flavors.
Yeah. So I was going to spend a little time kind of fleshing this out a little bit more. So you know, you can see what we're talking about here is a very foundational beginning state of kindred spirits, right? Coming together in a kin sense spiritually. You're not going to come together in a kin sense mindily to begin with because we are very different minds. But they do tell you that there is a, down the road a ways, there is a state where you can be kindred minds. See, and how you achieve that is you have to go up above all the things that are just innately dissonant now, right? You go up, and there is a harmony that's achievable. I mean, it's a harmony. It's not a uniformity, like you're saying. It's a harmony. But that harmony is what they're talking about with kindred minds. I mean, everyone is in the same sphere of truth. The reason you can't get together down here, everyone is in a sphere of their own falsehood. They can't. There's no way to come together in the same to be kindred minds down there. Right? Truth is the only way to achieve kindred minds, and that doesn't happen immediately. Right? But before you know, long before you're kindred minds, and there's peace on earth, right? You can challenge yourself to come together just spiritually. Forget about social, political, economic things. He's like, well, I can't. It's like, well, okay, well, then you can't, we can't have a real religious group then. We can have, we can have political parties, economic organizations, and social institutions. Yep. We can't have a religious institution.
In different buildings.
Right? Right, you know, we even have jokes about heaven, you know, with its separate rooms, you know, because you know you have the different you know, those three things I just described, you know, it's like, well, they're in this room, you know, and they think they're the only ones here, right? See, a spiritual brotherhood, I mean, it's easy to give lip service to that, but, I mean, it's really hardly even been imagined what it is that you're talking about. Those early Christians kind of got it, right? You know, they loved one another, right? Because, not because they all had the same political viewpoint, is in spite of the fact, right, of their political viewpoints. They were choosing to come together above that. Right? I mean, if you have a litmus test of political viewpoint, you're not going to, love is not going to be your motivating factor. Hatred will be. You're going to hate, not love, if you demand political uniformity. I don't care how many times you use the word love. You don't know what you're talking about. You're all about hate. By definition, you can't be anything else.
Silent
is out.
Political reformer.
It's just a given.
Isn't that the love that only loves you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the very fact that people are trying to use a clever species of self-deception, that they're really all about love, they have to constantly remind themselves by carrying around a sign that says love, not hate. Because they know they really are just all about hate. But if they carry the sign that says love, not hate, then, yeah, right. Virtue signaling is enough.
Yeah.
It's just, we have to recognize this is just what material gravity does. It's just the way we are naturally.
So I just want to be sure I know an exclusively spiritual brotherhood of God-knowing individuals. That would be on the fourth level of meaning. And the predicate for that would be God-knowing individuals individually on the sixth level of meaning.
Right. You start with the God-knowingness as a predicate, which is purely individual, you know, and you bring it down to the fourth level, you have a brotherhood, yes. Right? You're kindred spirits. Right. Start with the spirit, right, and then add kindred to it. Start with the sixth level of meaning, and add the fourth to it. Kindred spirits. Right. That's a starting point. We can all do that, especially now that we literally all have thought adjusters, right, to kind of factualize it even more. Right. This is achievable. It's not easy. Right. It's completely unnatural. Okay. So it's not easy. But it's doable even now. Kindred minds is not achievable right now. That's way in the future. Okay. You're lucky if you can get five people, you know, that achieve some level of, you know, of closeness to that in terms of philosophic sophistication, right? And just one other point on that. Remember, the fifth epical revelation is a big issue with that. Because it isn't the fourth, where he was just trying to foster the recognition that you can be kindred spirits, and the early Christians followed suit. Right? The fifth is actually challenging you to kindred minds. Right? So the fifth epical revelation isn't saying ignore the social, political, and economic things like Jesus said. It's saying no, look at them directly, and change your social, political, and economic thinking until we're all on the same page of kindred minds, right? It's actually trying to, it's addressing the fallacies of your political thoughts rather than just setting them aside. Because it's about ideas. This book is about ideas, not just ideals, like Jesus's mission. See, so, I mean, when step one is kindred spirits, this book is not directly going to help with that, right? Because it's actually, you know, encouraging you to not set aside the social, political, and economic things, but it's challenging you to recognize the fallacies of your economic theories and stuff. See, it's so, you know, and you know, the color of your skin thing, like I was saying, you know, colorblind. It's like, no, it's actually wanting you to notice the color of skin like you've never noticed it before. And notice it's even more problematic than you thought. You don't just have black and white. Okay, you've got six different sangic colors, right? And this person you've been calling a black person, he's actually a little bit more orange, isn't he? That, you know, and this one's a little bit more indigo. And see, that's not, if you start focusing on all those details, right, material gravity in your immature state is going to suck you down and out. You're going to lose kindred spirits. See, so this book is problematic, see, for most people. It's going to make the problem situation worse in a lot of ways. The fact that it does tell you your economic theory is really stupid. I mean, like I said, you know, it tells you your religious, your theology is grotesque. You know, see, I mean, again, like I said, this is not a kindred spirit book.
And here's how they do it on another planet.
I mean, this is, yeah. And, you know, we're about to get to a paragraph that reminds you that this is not a kindred spirit book. Okay. Yeah.
Sorry.
No.
This is fun.
No, see, but see, it's just, it's important. Every one of these paragraphs has a lot of complexity to it here.
I think it is. It's a pigment of your imagination.
Yes. Okay.
The religionist is not unsympathetic with social suffering, not unmindful of civil injustice, nor insulated from economic thinking. Neither insensible to political tyranny. Religion influences social reconstruction directly because it spiritualizes and idealizes the individual citizen. Indirectly, cultural civilization is influenced by the attitude of these individual religionists as they become active and influential members of various social, moral, economic and political groups.
Right. You said that. Right, yeah. See, we've been talking about this ever since, yeah, for the last hour and a half we've been talking about that paragraph. Right. That's, see, and again, because you need this institutional religion, you need this outer life fact, and like we said, nothing's changed. The only way to make that is having it, you know, distill out of the, you know, the greater cultural context. Okay, what you're adding is, you know, what can't be put out, you know, what isn't out there to distill naturally. You're going to have these individuals that are unnatural inside, and they're going to pour out fruits predicated on that unnatural predicate, and modify nature, right? You know, and that modified nature out there that's been uplifted now, right, is now going to distill a better institutional religion out of it. That's what all they're describing in that paragraph. That's the process. Just adding the conscious individual, like they're saying there. Because it spiritualizes and individualizes the individual citizen. That's what we're trying to add. Instead of the outer life defining the nature of the religionist, right? You know, he has a particular piety based upon the scheme that's been constructed, right? The source is inside. And that will change everything. You know, like I said, indirectly you'll get the fruits of the Spirit. It'll pour out. You know, and even notice that they're emphasizing cultural civilization. Right? Because we need to distill a cult out of that culture. Okay? Not just to some primitive, merely social civilization, right? And civilization is kind of in quotes. Right?
And remember when Simon couldn't convert the sun worshiper, Jesus said, well, I came to add something to the religion, not take something out of it. So
right.
The trick here is, as we were saying a minute ago, mm-hmm. It's got to be done evolutionarily.
Yes, right. Not revolutionarily. Yes. Yeah. So it's
one step at a time.
It's very complicated, very tricky. Yeah. And you have to be very patient. Just see to yourself and trust that the fruits will flow out, and those who are in charge of the outer world will, you know, will take care of things, right? All you need to worry about is yourself. I mean, it's actually really good news. It's like, you mean I don't have to try to fix everyone out there? No, just work on yourself. And then there's a whole mechanism. It'll flow out. Others will benefit. But not if you're just a chunk broken off of what's out there. You need to be different than what's out there.
Sounds like a lighter yoke.
Yes, it is a much lighter yoke. Yes.
Not really, because it's
right, it's difficult, right? Think about how many people just become catatonic, you know, trying to figure out how are we gonna fix all this stuff? It's like, you know, just take a deep breath. Right? You weren't put here to save the world. Right? You were put here to realize yourself. Okay.
The attainment of a high cultural civilization demands, first, the ideal type of citizen, and then ideal and adequate social mechanisms wherewith such a citizenry may control the economic and political institutions of such an advanced human society.
They're just reminding you kind of the physics we were talking about. I mean, you notice they said cultural civilization again, like I was saying. So you've got the individuals, right? And then as long as you haven't set up a system that blocks the fruits, it'll get out there. You know, so when they're talking about, you know, this ideal and adequate social mechanisms, wherewith, et cetera, that's one of the things, you know, when we set up the United States, right? They thought about all this. And that paragraph really is, you know, the predicate for the United States. The ideal type of citizen is talked about in the Declaration of Independence, right? And the ideal and adequate social mechanisms is laid out in the Constitution. They were thinking this paragraph when they set up the United States. We need to set up a mechanism, you know, we're going to lay it all out in the Constitution precisely. We're not just going to let it freewheel like Great Britain. We're going to lay it out specifically in a Constitution, right, so that we have ideal and adequate social mechanisms wherewith the citizenry, et cetera, right? That's how we're set up. We're the first and really still only, right, attempt to actualize that paragraph on this planet, right? But if technically the mechanism is still there, if the individuals go dark, right, then, you know, the fruits stop, plus, you know, they won't even recognize, well, what's the point of this mechanism? Let's just throw this mechanism out and let's just let it flow naturally again. And you know that's where we are. That's what people are advocating for now, you know, in this emergency situation we're in.
Get this mechanism.
And it's just it's so annoying. It's a mechanism. I mean, yeah, the mechanisms are evil. They block self-assertion.
Yeah.
The battle cry of my rebellion.
We've not grown it.
Right, it's the Lucifer Rebellion. Yeah.
The Church, because of an overmuch false sentiment, has long ministered to the underprivileged and the unfortunate. And this has all been well, but this same sentiment has led to the unwise perpetuation of racially degenerate stocks, which have tremendously retarded the progress of civilization.
I told you there was a paragraph coming. Post that one on Twitter.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
See what happens.
And hide.
Right.
From your deathbed, maybe.
First they have to recognize what you've said.
Right. So, see, again, notice you've, like you're saying, it's not, sentiment is not bad, you know, innately. Okay, the problem is it's false sentiment instead of true sentiment. Right? It's you know, the simplest thing that's making it false, it's not predicated on the facts. Right? It's predicated on imaginings, you know, illusions, like all men are born equal, right, say in recent times, right? You know, you're not taking into account racial facts. It's like I was saying, this book wants you to focus on racial facts. Okay, that's going to blow up Kindred Spirits. Because no one is sophisticated enough to hold on to Kindred Spirits and think about racial facts at the same time, basically. Yeah. So you're just going to lose the whole effort to have Kindred Spirits. Like, wait a minute, this is saying that black people are basically secondary Sangiks, you know. This is an abomination, you know. This is the American Mein Kampf, right? That's the kind of things that you'll get, and that's what you get out there, right? Anyone on the planet with any sophistication that's actually read a paragraph like that in the book calls this the American Mein Kampf. What else are they going to do, right?
Read more than a paragraph.
They have no kindred spirit predicate that they're holding on to.
And understand that we're blended.
Right.
Yeah. It's not one thing.
Of course, right. But we all know. See, this is just a huge problem. Like I said, this book is not going to really work on the kindred spirit thing. It's going to cause lots of problems. But anyway, so you've got to see that false, you know, that whole issue of falseness. And of course, you know, unwise, see, again, it's a philosophic issue. And degenerate. Remember, you know, this is not just defective, more of a horizontal thing. It's a vertical thing they're talking about.
Yeah.
Right? Degenerate's a vertical word. Right, see, so it is just an abomination to political correctness. How dare you order people, you know, vertically? That's an abomination to some material equality notion that everyone, you know, loves to have or pretend that they have. okay, so yeah, that's, you know, again, like I said, I mean, you go, well, why would they? I was thinking this would be a great section to give to my friend. Why did they put that stink bomb paragraph in the middle of it? Because, again, you're thinking you'd like to foster what Jesus told you to foster, and Jesus didn't say, take the Urantia book out into the world. That's not what Jesus said. Right? They're reminding you that. This is not what you want to do. If that's your job, is to foster the recognition of kindred spirits and to see if you can get Jesus' desired spiritual brotherhoods established. Yeah. Right?
That idea is a lot like the guy who decided he wanted to be have one wife and mm-hmm. he got killed by the
right, yeah. Dismissed his whole harem and the parents of all the ladies descended upon him and killed him. Yes, right.
I've been given the untold story of Jesus. There's a beautiful book with wonderful pictures, which the Rancher book doesn't have, of course.
Right.
But the sentiment behind it, you had to separate it from the other three parts of the book.
Because if yeah, you had to even separate it from a lot of things that are in part four.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I haven't studied it, so I haven't read it.
Yeah, there's some stink bombs in part four, too, right?
Some of those are taken out.
Well, I mean, again, you just can't lay out all of part four.
No.
You know? Well, I mean, you don't want to tell someone that. You're trying to start. You're trying to start kindred spirits. You don't want to say your prayer is an abomination. That's not an good opening salvo for fostering kindred spirits. I mean, you know, the only place in the book they talk about prayer as an abomination is in part four. I mean, you think it'd be in paper 91. It's like, no, it's in part four. Okay.
It fosters lots of good thinking.
Yeah.
And it's it's a good, helpful transition kind of thing. It's presented beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
It's, but it's not, I mean, they didn't take the whole thing and plop it over there. That wouldn't be appropriate.
Anyway, I don't want to spend too much time on the problems with the Urantia book, but you know, because we're trying to more immediately recognize these issues about religion here. But anyway, let's keep going.
Many individual social reconstructionists, while vehemently repudiating institutionalized religion, are, after all, zealously religious in the propagation of their social reforms. And so it is that religious motivation, personal and more or less unrecognized, is playing a great part in the present-day program of social reconstruction.
Okay, here's what you're asking me about at the beginning. See, here we're talking about using the word religion, and they say, after all, zealously religious in the propagation of their social reforms. Zealously is your clue. Okay? Everyone's got the sixth adjutant. Everyone's got the religious impulse. And if you don't apply it up to ideals, you apply it horizontally to an idea, right, and make it an ideology, right, in that negative sense of the word ideology. Right, that's, you know, that's what they're talking about. The only way you have these aggressive social reconstructionists, you know, is because of the sixth adjutant. They're using their religious impulse for, you know, energizing their social consciousness. Yeah. All of these different ways, you know, and of course, that's just, you know, remember when we talked about evolutionary religion, I mean, basically evolutionary religion is just the consequences of everyone having a sixth adjutant. You know, I mean, it's just the sixth adjutant playing out in its natural, unguided way, produces the whole ghost cult thing and all that sort of stuff.
Right? And by definition, that is not wise.
Yes, and that's right.
If an ideology gets a social grip, it's by definition being institutionalized.
Yeah, of course. Right. Yeah. See, and again, it's a difficult thing because, like, well, if you're actually going to get something established, you've got to bring in some zeal. It all has its place in the evolutionary process, but they're really telling us this stuff because they're saying you've got to stop doing what comes naturally. I mean, it's you've crossed the line where applying the sixth adjutant to ideas is now going to be a net negative from now on. It was a net positive in its evolutionary time, but you know, now it's going to be more destructive than constructive to do that. And so, you've got to get yourself cleared up inside.
Speedily cease this.
Yeah, speedily cease. You must speedily cease this, yes. All right. Anything else there? I think we can keep going.
The great weakness of all this unrecognized and unconscious type of religious activity is that it is unable to profit from open religious criticism and thereby attain to profitable levels of self-correction. It is a fact that religion does not grow unless it is disciplined by constructive criticism, amplified by philosophy, purified by science, and nourished by loyal fellowship.
Yeah, see, so when you start talking like that, see, in order for this to be true religion, right, it has, like I've said many times already, see, it has to have that full context. Right? There is no such thing as true religion apart from all this other stuff. And, just the almost blasphemy in a historical sense of saying purified by science. To use the word purify, right, and science in the same phrase. We'll get to that again here in a second. But this whole bit, you know, and that's why I talk about it all the time. I mean, people need to recognize that when they make an ism, they're unwittingly using the sixth adjunct, their religious impulse, for an idea. Okay, and then we need to consciously recognize this and go, oops, I shouldn't be doing that. I've misapplied my sixth adjunct. I need to have it tied to an ideal, which I then use philosophy and scientific understanding and stuff to bring down into a well-formed idea and apply. Right? The zeal will be there, but it'll be in the motive instead of, you know, in the intent. So it's just this unbridled horse, you know, running for the, you know, for the wall.
This is all safe in the hands of an ideal citizen, which the framers referred to as a people under God.
Right. You know, you've got to start with, you know, you, the individual, are endowed by your Creator.
Natural man instinctively feels he won't be effective if he doesn't apply that zeal directly.
Yeah, exactly. Right. The political party, when it fails, concludes every single time, we didn't have the zeal knob at a high enough number. You know, they
double down next time.
Yeah, they snap it past its limit and write 11, 12, 13, 14, and they just keep cranking it. All right.
There is always the great danger that religion will become distorted and perverted into the pursuit of false goals, as when in times of war each contending nation prostitutes its religion into military propaganda. Loveless zeal is always harmful to religion, while persecution diverts the activities of religion into the achievement of some sociologic or theologic drive.
Okay, that just when I saw the loveless zeal, that reminded me I was going to make a comment. Go back a couple paragraphs when we were talking about the zealously religious. Notice it goes beyond that, and it says, and so it is that religious motivation, personal and more or less unrecognized. Forgot to add that a little addition. Okay, it isn't merely the sixth adjunct that they're talking about there. But they're adding that in that next statement that I just read. You're adding in some will. It's zeal on steroids. It's fanaticism. And you'll see that's coming up here. I wanted to make sure I said that and I forgot. Here they're talking about kind of the other way where, you just are completely applying zeal to these very material ideas like war, issues, and have this loveless zeal. But it's also a problem when you have love, genuine love. You have to make sure that you don't distort this, and use those energies up there on the sixth level of meaning to make zeal worse. We'll see that here in a second. see anything else we should mention there? Kind of as a This next little listing is really important. I just want to make sure we have all the predicates for it here. Notice that they said here there is always the great danger. And then that, again, it's that you're going to slip into having a domination that you don't want to have going on. All right, let's just read that whole list all at once here.
Religion can be kept free from unholy secular alliances only by 1, a critically corrective philosophy, 2, freedom from all social, economic, and political alliances. 3, creative, comforting, and love-expanding fellowships. 4, progressive enhancement of spiritual insight and the appreciation of cosmic values. 5, prevention of fanaticism by the compensations of the scientific mental attitude.
Okay, so let's just step through those. So, religion can be kept free from unholy secular alliances only by. So, this religion we're talking about here, see, I mean, obviously, we're not just talking about this purely inner life individual thing now. We're talking about, you know, having it pour out and get socialized into an institutional religion that you're going to keep free from all these, you know, these issues. Okay? So it starts out, you know, like everyone, you know, recognizes as they go through these 5 papers on the nature of religion, philosophy. It has to be put in an overarching, encompassing philosophic context that, so they took in from that higher vantage point, you can keep things separated critically, right? Corrective, right? And don't all mush together. That's all important. We'll talk about philosophy constantly as we go through these papers. The second one we've already, you know, that's just putting in a bullet point what we've been saying. It's got to be freedom from all social, economic, and political alliances. And you could say, well, how do you do that? We were wondering exactly how do you prevent, especially the social thing, right? Because it's just so immediate and unwitting that you slip into bringing social stuff in. The next one gives you a hint. Creative, comforting, and love-expanding fellowships. Let's start with the last part, because that's the really key part. Love-expanding fellowships, not service-expanding fellowships. These things that we call institutional religion are dedicated as service-expanding fellowships. Right, that's what, you know, the moment you start thinking you're a service expanding fellowship, you're going to slip right into the social.
But in the service, though.
See, and that's where
the ministry aspect of
Of
the love,
right?
Mercy and ministry.
Exactly, right. But remember what they just told you. There's going to be service, but as an individual out there. If your group is dedicated to that, it's not a religious group anymore. It's a social group. That's the tricky part. And they've been trying to stress that. Right? Love is, okay, and we're talking love on the sixth, you know, it's a personal realization of divine fellowship expanding group. Right? They're dedicated to fostering in each individual, this is their group activity, a greater, in that individual, personal realization of divine fellowship. Right? And if that person achieves that, there are automatic fruits of the Spirit. They go out as an individual into a political context or, you know, a social context, and those fruits pour out. But it's not a group activity, the service. If it is, it's not a religious group anymore. Like I said, that one line there is one of the most important things in the whole book talking about religion and trying to clear this up. See, and the other things that come with that, love expanding fellowship, okay, comforting, right? Don't think the thing on your bed, right? Not the warm, fuzzy thing. Right, but spiritual strength. See, this group is dedicated to love expanding on the sixth level of meaning. You know, genuine spiritual nature. You know, getting a hold of your spirit, the upper domain, so that you have spiritual strength. Right, put some warp fibers into your life instead of nothing but the fuzzy woof ones. See, like I'm saying, is the, you know, we think of a comforter. That's the fuzzy woof, you know, fibers. It's the warp fibers that the group is supposed to be. It's not supposed to be, oh, let me be all sappy. No, that's not a religious group. Right? The religious group is fostering the non-fuzzy fibers, right? The strength, spiritual strength fibers.
Less crying wolf and more warp drive.
It's, see, again, it's like, wait a minute, it's just the exact opposite. Yeah. See, a real religious group is the exact opposite of what's called a religious group, because what's called a religious group is directed outward. A real religious group is directed inward. It's the exact opposite. Right? And, of course, the other thing you get there, if you're fostering the upper domain, is genuine creativity. Bringing something into existence that isn't already out there. It only happens in the upper domain. If you get something, you know, grown up there, you know, through this creativity process, you know, that isn't already out there, well, that flows out and now it's out there. You've actually improved the circumstance in the world. There's no creativity out there. There's no creativity in the lower domain. There's only creativity in the spiritualized mind in the upper domain. There's cleverness and inventiveness in the lower domain. Creativity is only in the upper domain. Originality is only really in the upper domain. You know, cleverness masquerades as originality, but it's not really original.
It's like uniformity instead of unity.
Right. It's just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic in a way no one ever thought of doing before. Doesn't get rid of the iceberg. So that one, number three, is very key. We've already talked about, you know, the progressive enhancement of spiritual insight and the appreciation of cosmic values. Again, that upper domain, you know, aspects of the upper domain. And then number five, prevention of fanaticism by the compensations of this scientific mental attitude. That's why I went back and remind you of that personal thing. So you've got this upper domain. So you've got the zeal on the second level of meaning with the sixth adjutant. But you can make zeal worse. You can turn it into fanaticism if you bring in the kind of energizing of your mind that the third cosmic intuition does, that spiritual insight. If you bring that in without any cosmic balance, if you just bring it in as an accelerant for the sixth adjutant, you'll get fanaticism, even worse than zeal. Okay, the only way to prevent that is, so you've got to use the three cosmic intuitions as a triunity. And in particular, the first thing is just its balance. You've got your religious consciousness on the sixth level of meaning, but you got to bring in your scientific consciousness on the fourth. First cosmic intuition, right? Grounding in facts and causality. Right?
Purified by science?
Yeah, purified by science. And balanced, see. The only way to not become a fanatic, if you start amping up your religious consciousness, is if you have that first cosmic intuition counterbalance. If you brush that aside, say hello to fanaticism, and you'll have to be put down.
Yeah.
So, right? You're a rogue elephant. Okay.
So the fanatic, by definition, is disregarding cause and effect, or causal. You think so?
Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. Right.
Now you're zealous for all.
We sailed out of the harbor.
Yeah, see, a fancy animal is merely zealous, but an unfortunate human can be a fanatic.
Right? He's on the speedboat and he's blind.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so lots there to think about. Let's see if we can wrap it up here.
Religionists as a group must never concern themselves with anything but religion, albeit any one such religionist as an individual citizen may become the outstanding leader of some social, economic, or political reconstruction movement.
See, I've already stressed that, see? Yeah. As a group, that's the thing. So just, and you go, well, then what is the group? That's why I said number three. It's a love-expanding fellowship, not a service-expanding fellowship, that group.
And it's about religion.
It's about religion. It's about the inner life, not the outer life.
See, in service divorced by zeal isn't loving service anymore. Mm-hmm. Right? It's loveless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's just it's all right there. It's actually laid out pretty point blank, but it's not been recognized well.
It is the business of religion to create, sustain, and inspire such a cosmic loyalty in the individual citizen as will direct him to the achievement of success in the advancement of all these difficult but desirable social services.
So again, kind of just saying what we've been saying, but you know, they added a little threefold: create, sustain, inspire. So visualize that. I already told you, the upper domain is where there can be create, where there's creativity. Okay, so you start out, you originate something up there, and then you use your synchronization with the cosmos, through the Holy Spirit, to sustain it up there, and then you inject that influence down into the lower domain. You inspire the lower domain. You inspirit the lower domain. The spiritualized mind is up here. Right? If you direct that down, you've inspired that lower domain. And then that flows out to the world. Okay? Create, sustain, inspire. Okay? And it'll automatically flow out because that lower domain is in an interplay. You can't turn that off. Yeah, it'll flow out. So that's the process. And again, just individuals will do this. But if religious groups try to do it, they aren't religious groups and none of this will happen. Because there's nothing natural about this whole inner person being there.
It doesn't mean that individual can't be in a group.
Yeah.
But the group itself is...
They can be in a social group and do those things, but if they're in their religious group, they don't do those things. They certainly don't talk about
politics. Not as a group, but as the individual.
Yeah, as the individual. Right. They're just trying to get the individual and the group. See, evolutionary religion has always had a difficult time separating the individual from the group. I mean, remember how priests are a big reason for this. It's like you can't think of yourself as an individual religionist because, you know, you have no way to, as an individual, to get to God. You need a priest as an intermediary. See, it's a group phenomenon by definition when there's priests.
Or a saint.
You got to push the priests out of the way, right? So that you can be in an individual religionist, right? Have a genuine inner life fostered by your religious group that has nothing to do with anything but religion. And then you go out as that individual religionist and produce a much better economic system than the meatheads that are doing it now, that have no cosmic consciousness, right? I mean, what kind of a political or economic theory are you going to come up with when you're devoid of cosmic consciousness? A very poor one, right? The ones that we're suffering under. All right. So, we'll get into the transition difficulties next time. But, everyone, go back and work through this yourself. And see if you can get some of these points to sink in all the more. You know, make sure you understand what a love-expanding fellowship is. That's a very, very important point. Okay, let's take a moment, everyone.